Ibrahim Fakir, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Shukran for having me, Mona.
Well, let's start with Omicron. The emergence of the new variant of the COVID-19 virus has resulted in fears of rapid transmissibility. It has sparked rumors that South Africa could enter a period of lockdown, and it has dampened the holiday cheer and mood. Now, the experts are saying there's no need for panic about the severity and the impact, and they are advocating sensible caution. It was predicted all along that the fourth wave would arrive by late November or early December. There were fears around the role that the election would play in all of that. But the evidence seems to suggest that the Omicron variant of the virus was present in places like Scotland, Botswana, Hong Kong, Belgium, and in some cases, as Scotland has now confirmed, even before it was prevalent in South Africa. Now, the controversy and the debate around lopsided inequities and international politics and international relations aside, the issues and implications seem to be much closer to home. First, it doesn't seem as if the elections were a super spreader, as was feared. And despite the numbers, President Ramaphosa did not take the country into a higher lockdown level. Now, the question has come about, and the focus seems to be on vaccine uptake, which has waned, and this has prompted government to initiate an inquiry into the viability and modalities and implications of a vaccine mandate. So, Ibrahim, what does a vaccine mandate imply, and what implications for South Africa are they? Those who are not vaccinated or who are reluctant for whatever reason to get vaccinated, does it not raise fears about the rights to choice and major ethical issues, and probably gives the government too much of coercive power?
Well, in some senses, yes, that's the fear. The fear is that there'll be far too much coercive power. You'll be making people do things against their will. You'll be making people do things to something that they might ordinarily object to. But I think the reality here is that you have to balance up and weigh up the considerations. They're constitutional and they are legal considerations, right? And, you know, there are other issues now which are emerging in the science. Now, the one argument seems to suggest that this new variant, whatever it is, and the sites aren't clear, so let's just put that disclaimer up front, may in fact evade the vaccine protection which is provided, or it even evades the protection which is provided by natural immunity by those people who may have been infected before. Now, some people are using this argument to say, don't yet implement a vaccine mandate. And by vaccine mandate, as you asked, it means compulsory vaccination. Now, that seemingly sleight of hand argument is now appearing to say, first investigate whether this variant can evade natural immunity or can evade the immunization which is provided by a vaccination. But it's a sleight of hand argument because the science is not clear. What the science is clear about, and of course I'm not a scientist, so I'm speaking on the basis of interpretation of things that I've read, is that the vaccines do protect and do provide a degree of protection, even though it may not be complete, number one. Number two, the question of vaccine mandate, which is where I can probably speak about with greater authority, is about the imposition of a decree by a government about a fundamental requirement in order to be able to do certain things. Now, let's not lose sight of the fact that there are many things in which you are compelled to do something in order to access them. For example, you could not have been enrolled at a school or any public facility if you were not vaccinated against rubella, against measles, against any number of diseases, right? School-going children have to have those vaccines, otherwise they are ineligible to attend those schools. Second, some countries you visit, for example, even if you go for Hajj or Umrah, unless you have a yellow fever certificate and so on, you are unlikely to be, or not unlikely, you are not allowed to either enter or to return home. So that kind of mandatory imposition has already been in evidence for a range of issues. Some people's argument is on this issue, the vaccination has not been tested for as long as the other vaccines are tested, and therefore they're happy about taking those, but not this one. The truth is that this one has, in fact, been tested for quite some time. Not in this form, obviously, but it's, remember, this disease is a variant of a series which have existed already, right? And they were testing vaccines for that. This one simply needed certain amendments, and they found over rigorous testing after instituting emergency protocols that it does have some veracity, and therefore it's okay to be used. So all these fears that this is about manipulation and control and government imposition, giving governments too much power, are far too sinister and far too conspiratorial. I mean, this government can't run a municipality properly. So trust me, I don't think that they're going to use something as sophisticated as this as a mind control tool. So I think that fear should be parked aside. Now, on the question of a vaccine mandate, it appears as if it may be necessary, because not only does the Constitution in some way allow for this, because when the Constitution argues that the right to individual choice and integrity and bodily integrity is a fundamental value, it also means my bodily integrity. And if your inability to vaccinate yourself is going to affect my rights, then you are obliged to do something in order to protect me. So this is the argument of your rights end where someone else's rights begin. That's the first issue to address on the question of rights. On the second issue of rights is that the secondary legislation by statute, which does in fact allow for this. First is, if you think of things like the Employment Equity Act and the Health and Safety Act, the second set of legislation. Those things say that you must take certain steps, do certain things in order to be able to work, because it is an inherent requirement for you to do so in order to work. So, for example, if you're in a wheelchair, right, and you are offered employment somewhere, they have to make sure that they provide the facilities for you to use, because it's an inherent requirement for you to have access to those things in order to do the job. Logically, if you make a comparison, it is fundamental and required of you to be vaccinated in order to protect those other people around you. The Employment Equity Act makes a similar requirement about having to fulfill certain minimum criteria in order to be eligible, what they would call, as I say, an inherent requirement to fulfill certain aspects of a job or a workplace. And a whole range of other places can use that logic to say, in order to access service A or enter place B or do thing C, it is an inherent requirement for you to have the following. And in that way, it appears as if the mandates may, in fact, pass muster. But government's obviously still, as President Ramaphosa announced, is still investigating the modalities and whether it should do so. There are other arguments which say, look, don't go the route of the mandate yet. You don't need to be that coercive. Maybe you should try two other things. A, expand the number of sites which are available, because at the moment, in certain areas, they may be too limited. B, reduce the cost of getting a vaccine. So it's easy for relatively middle-class people, even though there's no cost to the vaccine, you know, transport, getting to a site, taking off day from work, perhaps. Those costs are associated with having to go to get a vaccine. So make it easier, make it more convenient, expand the number of sites, reduce the barriers to entry, in other words. And that might have better uptake and have a better education campaign or public campaign, communications campaign. Those things might be a first step towards this process, rather than implementing a mandate which forces everyone to do so. Because the you know, if people are persuaded, more people will take it, and then you might have the kind of immunity required to reduce the strength of the virus. But who knows whether it's too late to have that kind of approach now.
Yeah. Well, coming to the elections again, I mean, the results, as we know, were quite astonishing. The ANC, although it had the largest share of the votes, it did not have a clear majority in six out of the major metros. We know what happened here in Gauteng with the three metros. They were kept out by what seems to be a coalition of small parties, and this would not have been possible without the help of the EFF. But it doesn't mean now that there's actually a government formed, and discussions seem to be ongoing between the parties. It raises major issues about both political and governmental uncertainty and instability, doesn't it, Ibrahim?
I think, unfortunately, that's what we're facing. We're facing both politicized uncertainty and what I would call institutionalized ambiguity. And I say so because, look, it's uncertain, as you rightly say, right? They've elected speakers and mayors, and let's just focus on Gauteng for a moment. I mean, by hook and crook, the ANC managed to keep Etiqueni in Durban by making a deal with someone because they lost that metro as well. The only metros in which they won a clear majority was actually in Buffalo City, East London, and Mangaung. And in Mangaung also, it was literally by the skin of their teeth, right? But they managed to maintain Etiqueni by a deal, and the same is true for PE Nelson Mandela Bay, now known as Gqeberha. But let's just focus on Gauteng. In Gauteng, they were elected with the help of the EFF, the speaker and the mayor. But there's no executive council yet. So there's no people in the executive to carry those portfolios. They must still decide that. There is no decision yet on not only who carries those portfolios, but how they will part the budget, whether they will support the budgets which are actually proposed by the mayors and so on. So what's going to happen? Or what it seems like is likely to happen. Because the agreement is not a coalition, and because it's in fact a minority government, which has been placed in power by support of certain bits of smaller parties, one or other of those, including the EFF, might lurch from issue to issue to supporting you, and then come up a new issue, don't support you. Or they may make all kinds of demands in exchange for the support, and if you aren't able to give in to their demands, they will then simply collapse that government. So that leads to the kind of uncertainty that you're talking about. It's potential, the potential is there. But when I say it's politicized, I mean it will be used for incremental political advantage. So I'm going to use my little support that you need to make it unable for you to be able to govern properly, even though on the face of it looks like I'm giving you the power to do so. But they might claim, no, they're not going to do that. They might claim, no, we're actually doing this because we are making sure we keep the ANC out of power. That no one can know, because we can't foresee what's going to happen. But given the trend, given the what we know, given the impulse of how we interpret what these parties are about, I think it seems to me unlikely that they will simply proceed apace and continue to lend their support whenever necessary, until and unless they can extract some gains. So that uncertainty will be politicized, not used for political advantage. And it's clear when they say to you, we are doing this because, well, the one party says our ambition is to ensure that we keep the ANC out of power. The next party says, no, we are doing this because we are here not to revive the ANC, but to destroy it. So it's clear why they will use this. And they will do this in order to position themselves for the next election. So it's all about incremental internal politics. And I think they lose sight of the fact that in the lead up to the elections, in competitive politics, in a democratic politics, it's fine, you're competing, you do all of those things. Once you transition from a mode of democratic politics to democratic government, a completely different set of instruments and thinking should start to apply. You are here to service a constituency. You are here to ensure that there's stability in public management, that the resources are distributed and implemented on the basis of what you said you were going to do. Your campaigning can begin for the next election in that way, not by simply playing narrow politics. And that's what I fear is going to do. So that's the politicized uncertainty. The institutionalized ambiguity will come about because the institutions are there, but will not be serving the purpose and the mandate that they are intended for or they were established for. They will be used merely for the basis of politicking. And that's a really scary thought, because it means even if you take the 8 metros, and the ANC will have some stability or at least govern coherently, maybe in 2, and the DA in 1 in Cape Town, it leaves you out of the 8 metros, 5, which are going to be hamstrung by what I just described. Now, 5 of those metros are the ones which literally drive the growth, development, and redistribution agenda of the country. If you're unable to have influence, stability in those areas, then your opportunity for real stability and real growth and real redistribution is in fact and becomes limited over time. So unfortunately, it seems to me we're looking at a rocky ride, and inshallah, let's hope some kind of sanity prevails amongst them and that we do in fact have stability rather than kind of politicized uncertainty and institutional ambiguity.
I mean, now coming to the hearing, right? The Human Rights Commission, their hearing into what you call the insurrection is expected to conclude by the 3rd of December. Apart from what we already know in terms of the revelations, what seems to be troubling is not the evidence itself, but revelations of the extent of the dysfunctionality, not just politically, but in the police itself. Becky Cayley saying he had to work with the Deputy National Police Commissioner because the National Commissioner was nowhere to be found. The National Commissioner denies this, but he never, visited the affected areas. The Provincial Commissioner claiming that the former Defence Minister, or the Defence Minister at the time, who's now the Speaker of Parliament, her testimony was pure fabrication. She claims that when the SANDF was deployed in the province, there was no cooperation from the Provincial Police. It sounds petty, but more than petty, it's confusing.
Well, if you want to evade taking responsibility for something, or you want to evade being accountable for something, what's the best way of doing so? Obfuscate. Ridicule, complicated. Make it so endlessly complicating that it's impossible to unravel what's actually happened, right? And when you eventually do, then someone finds some nitpicking thing to object to, or to say this wasn't done by proper procedure, or I want to contest this issue, or I want to cross-examine this person because they didn't actually tell you the truth. Here, I've got new documents for you. Let me show you. So that's the best way of evading accountability. The second is, unfortunately, this thing has not been covered as well as it should have. Focus has not been on this. And it's vital to know because, when I talk about this institutionalized ambiguity and politicized uncertainty, here's a fantastic example. Whether the minister works with the commissioner or the deputy national commissioner, does it matter? He worked with someone. That the national commissioner was not present, that the national commissioner was not visible, those are issues, those are problems. But I don't understand why the minister is moaning that I had to work with the deputy national commissioner. Whoever you work with doesn't matter. Carry out the mandate that you have in terms of the authority which is delegated to you, by A, by cabinet, if you're a minister, and B, by the act that establishes the police service and gives powers and functions to the deputy commissioner. So I don't see why that's a problem. Now, it is a problem that the national commissioner wasn't visible. But can you see the tit-for-tat, the spit-for-spat kind of thing? The minister blames the commissioner. The commissioner says, no, I was around. He should have got in touch with me if he wanted something. And then the guy says, no, I worked with the deputy national commissioner. Well, it looks like there's a bit of a blame game going on. It gets worse. It gets much worse. If you listen to the testimony that happened at the commission, the Commissioner for KwaZulu-Natal, like you say, says the defense minister was uncooperative and that her testimony at the commission was a fabrication. She, in turn, claims when they went there and she deployed the defense force to complement the police, through the provincial commissioner, was uncooperative. So now, again, you've got people who are engaged in a blame game. That's the political reading. The public service reading is that the police is one of those institutions which has power and authority spread between the national level and the provincial level. And there are levels of accountability both nationally and provincially. And it's clear that in the intergovernmental relations between the different spheres and the different tiers, that the coordination that's required, envisaged by the act that creates the intergovernmental relations, is not being followed, or has not even been properly interpreted, or their roles and functions are not clear even to those who have the authority to carry it out. Which simply tells you that, apart from the fact that they're all playing politics, is that it seems as if it's not just politics and evil and malevolent intention, but it is also mere incompetence, that you're using something where you're not clear about the lines of accountability and lines of responsibility, and using that as an excuse for evading responsibility for something which had a major impact on not just the country, but ordinary people's lives, people's businesses, and poor people who actually reliant on those jobs. They've literally lost them. But are the people in authority taking any responsibility? No, because they both playing politics, and B, don't seem to know what their roles, functions, and responsibilities in terms of the authority granted them actually are.
Ibrahim, as always, jazakumullah for your time, for the insightful perspective. Really appreciate it.
Assalamu alaikum
wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. That was this week's Asri Report with political analyst and head of programs, director for programs at Asri, Ibrahim Fakir.